Hello, it's Monday, March the 7th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail Newsroom. Coming up, it's Food Waste Action Week. You're going to be amazed when I tell you how much food we're wasting every single day. The government, is it finally going to see sense about net zero and reopen the whole debate about fracking? Also, the oligarchs, the Commons are debating how to get tougher. Why is Britain much slower than the EU and the United States in cracking down? But first, we're going to Ukraine to talk to our correspondent, Ian Birrell. Britain's top military commander suggests that Vladimir Putin's decimated forces could actually lose the war in Ukraine, and he confirms the invasion is not going well. Admiral Sir Tony Radican, the former head of the Royal Navy, who was appointed chief of the defence staff last year, was speaking after 8 Russian aircraft were shot down in 24 hours. I'm joined now by Daily Mail writer Ian Birrell in Ivano-Frankivsk in Ukraine. Ian, just describe, if you can, where you are and what the mood is like around you.
Well, I'm in at the moment. I'm in southwest Ukraine, so that's although the town I'm in was attacked on the first night, probably from Transnistria in Moldova. It's not getting direct hits all the time like other parts. But what's so interesting is you do see the unified sort of efforts to help. So the volunteer efforts everywhere here is still very militarized. We have martial law. There's troops who are in every official building and the public buildings. People get asked for their documents a lot. There's no alcohol being sold anywhere in the country. So it is a whole country is very quickly moved onto war footing. And it's quite tense because of what's happening with all the numbers of refugees coming through. This town has seen its population go up 15% in a week because of the number of refugees coming in.
And where are they coming from, Ian?
Coming from all over where I am now. There were trains coming in last night from Kharkiv and from Sumy in the north, from Kiev and from Mariupol down in the south. So people are basically going from the east of the country to the west of the country, and many of them then going beyond into other countries.
And we know in places like Kiev and other places, Ian, food and water, essential supplies are running low. How is it where you are?
For things like that, it's okay. The issue is to feed all the extra numbers of people and to care for people who have fled with absolutely nothing. Many of them are turning up with literally nothing, just maybe one backpack with a few clothes in or a pet or something like that. So people are going to extraordinary lengths to find food, accommodation, to help people. And in many ways, it's quite inspiring to see the sort of communal spirit to help people in need at this time.
Yeah. And Ian, it must be horrific for local people to watch their TV or see what's the news on their telephones about what's happening in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense of shock and anger, you know, bewilderment, really, that so fast a country which was a modern European country with a modern European capital has been transformed in large swathes of it into hell. The fact that you're getting civilian bombing attacks is really upsetting everyone. Knows people in different parts of the country who are coming under attack, or they've got relatives there. And it's, you know, it's obviously incredible personal, and it's incredibly traumatic for the whole country to see what's going on, see the bombing, see the attacks, and particularly with all the lies about Putin saying that he won't attack civilian areas, and then seeing the shelling of civilian areas. And, you know, some absolutely horrifying images and pictures are coming through.
Just finally, Ian, is there much frustration where you are that the allies, NATO is continuing to say no to a no-fly zone? Is that an issue that people are talking about where you are?
I've hardly met anyone who hasn't asked why NATO is not backing no-fly zones.
Oh, really?
Everyone is desperate for them, and they see that as something to help, and they... Although people remain very pleased by the help and the solidity shown by Europe and by America on these issues, and I keep hearing praise for Britain's stance early on and for having a tough line, but there is real dismay that NATO is not backing them with things like no-fly zones. And in fact, I've just come out of a meeting with a prominent politician who spent a lot of the time saying that while they were very grateful for all the help and support, why is there not... support for no-fly zone.
Interesting. It's not going to go away, that as an issue, is it, Ian? That's the Daily Mail's writer, Ian Birrell. Ian, as ever, look after yourself, won't you?
Thank you.
Ian Birrell talking to us from southwest Ukraine. Craig McKinley is the MP for South Thanet, and he's chairman of the Net Zero Scrutiny Group and joins me now. Mr. McKinley, is it too late? In 2 weeks' time, they're going to shut these wells down, concrete them over. That's it.
Well, I've called this, Andrew, I've called it industrial vandalism. Why on earth would you, at a time when we've got not just a UK gas crisis, we've got a European gas crisis, and we have potentially an opportunity, because we've been gifted something by Mother Nature, and that is a lot of gas in this country. Why on earth would we continue to be importing gas when we have not exhausted the opportunities to look at what we have at home? This is a little bit like a well-funded campaign organisation encouraging the government to ban the growth of potatoes in the UK, and we just import them instead. We've got a unique situation. We've got a global problem. We've got a European and a UK problem. I mean, it's a very simple question. Do we want to continue importing gas and oil and coal, but gas particularly is the focus here? It can easily be recognized that what the West has done over the last years is finance Putin's war machine, and the true horror of that is now being rained down on the people of Ukraine. If we hadn't gone up that route, we wouldn't have been financing his war machine. So I don't want Britain to be any part of that for any longer than is necessary. And to me, there are so many good things about domestic gas production. There's a lot of jobs. The Institute of Directors did a report some time ago suggesting 74,000 jobs could arise from this. On the back of that, there would be a lot of tax revenue, and we need tax revenue at the moment in this country. The CO2 footprint of actually getting gas into our pipes, into our homes, through domestic production is about half of what it is through LNG ships being transported halfway around the world, funnily enough, on a diesel-powered ship. So the CO2 footprint is less as well. And another big problem we've always had in this country for a generation or more, probably longer, is a balance of payments issue. So domestic supply has got to be favourable than remitting oodles of UK cash to overseas jurisdictions, you know, friendly or hostile or otherwise. So put it all together, we've got an opportunity here. Why on earth are we going to concrete over the two potential wells upon which we could learn so much about an industry that could be our salvation?
The Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, that's Kwasi Kwarteng's mob, say, Russian gas is only 4% of British content. Well, 4% is too much.
Well, it is, but I think what that does is not entirely tell the truth, might I say, because we import a lot of Norwegian gas. Norway is our primary supplier. A lot of LNG from other parts of the world as well, Qatar, US, Trinidad, Tobago, a few other places. But if we were to inject our own gas into the system, that would mean friendly gas, i.e. Norwegian gas, could be taking up the slack somewhere else in Europe. So you inject a new supply into a system. I mean, I learned this in my first day doing economics as probably a 13-year-old schoolboy. You put more of a supply of something into a system, then the price comes down. So, yes, it's rather irrelevant that we're only 4% and we're okay, Jack, sort of. But Russian gas is one of the primary producers and is really dictating the international oil price. And wouldn't it be good if we could wean Europe off of Russian gas and get it onto Norwegian gas, because we're okay and we're supplying ourselves? And do you know what? We could even be exporting it ourselves as well. Now, that would be very good for our balance of payments problem that the country has always suffered from. So, yeah, I hear what they say, but it really doesn't tell the whole story.
And what of the impact on the environment, Mr. McKinley? We know there were some tremors when there was exploration up in Lancashire near Blackpool. 2.5 was it, or 2, and the government limit says the tremors can't be more than 0.5, which seems artificially rather low to me. What do you say to people who say you're going to despoil beautiful, fabulous countryside, and you're not can't be absolutely certain how much gas you're going to get in return?
Well, I've looked at what the National Geology Survey have actually come up with. They have done some reports some years ago, and the low-hanging fruit of just 10% of the potential shale reserves across particularly the Boland Shale region could be 50 years' worth of UK gas. Now, yes, well, there is this discussion about the seismic activity. 0.5, frankly, is so low, it's about like sitting in your own chair. That is the seismic activity. The US, upon which thankfully they've gone up this route and are now part of the mitigation of our own self-styled problems, because we're now getting US gas, and thank heavens they fracked for us in the past, they allow 2 as the limit. Now, 2 is still a very, very low limit, but, you know, I'm not the expert on these. The geologists are, the scientists are, and the potential companies that could do this. There are lots of new fracking techniques coming through because we've learned so much from the US. I am absolutely sure a way could be found, but we have got a decision to make. Are we happy to continue financing Putin's regime and his war machine, or are we willing to put up with, you know, just whatever small inconveniences that might arise from domestic supply? Probably the biggest inconvenience will be trying to unstick the glue from Extinction Rebellion as we do so. But I think that's a price worth paying.
Don't bother unsticking them. Leave them there.
Absolutely. But no, the thought that the Oil and Gas Authority have demanded and require Quadrilla to actually put cement down these holes as a permanent finish done at this time of global energy insecurity and the geopolitics of gas. This is really a war about gas. It is the foundation of this Ukraine war at the moment. To be doing that right now, to me, as I've said, is industrial vandalism and needs to be paused, suspended, thought about again. And we need to look very carefully as whether onshore shale, i.e. fracking, is a potential solution to get us out of this energy fix.
Well, the best of luck with it. That's Craig McKinley, MP. He's the Conservative MP for South Thanet, and he's chairman of the Net Zero Scrutiny Group. So almost 100 Russian oligarchs, politicians, have been sanctioned by the European Union and the United States, but not by Britain, which has sanctioned barely a dozen. Many have bought property, paid for private schools, enjoy luxury lifestyles in the UK, according to a joint investigation by the Daily Mail and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. So why not more action against them? I'm joined now by Susan Hawley, who's Executive Director of Spotlight on Corruption. Susan, the government will argue, I'm sure, that we've frozen hundreds of billions of pounds of Russian assets, much more than the European Union, but the oligarchs seem to be beyond the reach of the government. Why so?
The UK sanction legislation has got some kind of blockages in it, which, to be fair to the government, they're actually now trying to address in some amendments to the Economic Crime Bill that's going to go through this afternoon. But they do make it quite slow and unwieldy for the UK to act, and very prone to legal challenge, as well as potentially facing massive costs. So these amendments, depending on when they can be implemented, because we might not see the law actually on the books before May, would certainly help speed things up. But it may just, we don't know where we'll be in May. It may be just a little bit too late. But I think there's problems with the law, but there's also problems with just not enough resourcing and specialism in the system. We need like some really specialist lawyers and accountants, you know, at the Foreign Office, who have really built up an expertise to be able to turn these cases around really quickly. And that's what it's lacking at the moment. So it's a matter of, you know, there are some legal changes holding us up, and they are, you know, because of our new sanctions regime after leaving the EU, but there are also some serious resourcing issues.
And it's part of the problem. These oligarchs obviously have lots of money, and they can employ the very best, most powerful, clever lawyers in the land, but surely they don't have as much resources as a government, who presumably could employ equally high-powered lawyers too, if they were inclined to do so.
Well, you'd be amazed, but certainly when we've been looking at law enforcement, it's actually the opposite. Law enforcement have caps on how much they can pay lawyers.
Right.
Kleptocrats have no caps. Law enforcement and government can only go to one lawyer. What we've seen with some of these kleptocratic actors is they will go and employ all of the law firms, so none of them can act against them. So there's some, if you've got deep pockets in this country, you can buy, you know, over and above the kind of justice that any of us could ever dream of. And so I think unfortunately, you know, we saw this with the National Crime Agency when it tried to bring an unexplained wealth order against some Kazakh oligarchs. They got hit with a 1.5 million bill, which was going to wipe out about half of its budget. So I think, you know, it would be nice to think that the government could just get the best lawyers in the land. And that is actually, they need to work out how they can do that, because what we need is the best brains, legal brains, going into government and law enforcement to tackle this. There needs to be a big review. I mean, the US get it right. They have really proactive, aggressive enforcement. We've seen this with their announcement of a new interagency task force called KleptoCapture. You know, they're very agile, they're very strong, and they're very robust in how they approach these things. And we just don't have that culture or that infrastructure here, and we have to learn how to do it if we're going to get serious.
Well, the first thing they could start doing, Susan, is lifting the cap.
Yeah, they can absolutely lift the cap, and they can also do what they are trying to do with the Economic Crime Bill, which is reduce the costs. So they are introducing measures which would mean that law enforcement don't face costs if they behave reasonably. They're also trying to limit the damages. At the moment, under the bill, a lawyer could sue the Foreign Office for negligence in how it's imposed sanctions. And they're trying to remove that in the bill because you can see how that's very open to interpretation and plenty of legal challenges. So they are trying to close down the loopholes which would impose just such big costs, both on the Foreign Office and law enforcement. But I guess what I'm concerned about is whether, you know, these are all great measures. It's great that we're going to have a property register where people have to disclose who owns the $170 billion worth of property owned offshore in this country. But, you know, is it going to be too late to really impact on the current situation by the time we get these into law?
And on that, the register, is this now, have I got this correct, Susan, the government is giving the oligarchs, these rich businessmen and women, 6 months to get to be transparent, where the Labour Party is saying it should be 28 days?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some genuine challenges with creating the infrastructure. But that shouldn't stop the government requiring people to report straight away.
Right.
And it shouldn't stop the government introducing interim measures of getting special alerts out on all property and, you know, sales of shares and property. So there are ways that they could tackle it more immediately. And they need to do that, because 6 months, obviously, there's not going to be much many assets left in the UK at this point.
No, I should imagine they've got. That was the other thing, Susan. I mean, these oligarchs are no fools. This tension has been building between Russia and Ukraine for months. Isn't it likely that a lot of the money has been spirited away from the prosecutors in this country and in other countries too?
I think there are two things going on. One of them is just to get around sanctions, and there have been plenty of cases of this. It's very easy just to transfer your assets to your son or daughter or to your business associate. And we've seen press reports of this, you know, Gary Pasca giving his assets to the secretary in his office. And that completely evades the sanctions. So there's something wrong there as well. I mean, when they're sanctioning people, they need to make sure it's family members, it's the whole business network that are being sanctioned to really address this. I mean, the other thing is whether the overseas territory, so our Cayman Islands and our, you know, offshore Caribbean islands, are they playing their role? Because the strength of UK sanctions is it should apply across all those territories. And they have been the absolute engine of secrecy and helping these oligarchs hide their assets through multiple opaque structures. I think the danger is that these oligarchs just get clever at hiding their assets.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they always have the best legal advice to stay that one step ahead. And that's the risk.
Absolutely. Well, Susan, thank you for that. That's Susan Hawley. She's Executive Director of Spotlight on Corruption. Thanks for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gapp was here with the latest. Shane Warne. Do you know, I can remember he came into my newsroom when I was on The Times, probably 20 years ago. The whole place, ground to halt.
Really?
All sorts of famous people go into newsrooms, as you know, all the time, and nobody pays no interest. Prime Minister, who cares? Minor member of the Royal Family, nobody cares. Actress, nobody cares. Shane Warne, everything stopped.
I can imagine.
And he came and chatted to me, of all people, who knows nothing about cricket, but even I knew who he was.
Yeah.
Because he was one of those guys who transcended the sport, didn't he?
He did, and that's been clear of the tributes that have been paid over the weekend, is that he was a larger-than-life character. Yeah, yeah. I think that's what the shock comes from as well, that he was such a larger-than-life character. You know, that brilliant beaming smile. And it obviously taken far too young, and it's been interesting reading those tributes over the weekend, how popular he was beyond just the cricket world and how many people's lives he touched. It was interesting, I read one piece where he still introduced himself, you know, whenever someone met him, he introduced himself as Shane. We think, well, of course, we know who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
But that showed a sort of humility to him as well. Yeah. And so, really tragic and really interesting to see all those tributes paid to him. I mean, he gave me so many miserable days as an England fan, because he used to obviously torment England endlessly. So I used to sort of, you know, hate him really, because he'd be like, oh no, not him, him doing us again.
Best spin bowler ever, wasn't he?
Without a doubt. And but bigger than that, a wonderful showman and a wonderful, he sort of made Test cricket sexy. You know, Test cricket isn't always sexy, as you know. But if he was bowling, it was a must watch, because he brought the entertainment and the theatre to it. He would sledge the opposition. You could see he was enjoying it. And you could see that he was the centre of attention. He loved it. Yeah. And there was a great story that Andrew Strauss told over the weekend, that Warne was actually batting at this point against Ashley Giles, the England bowler who was bowling, and Shane Warne knocked the ball back to Ashley Giles. Strauss then said, come on, Giles, you've got him in trouble here, you've got Warne in trouble here. And Warne said, if you say one more word, I'm going to hit him for six. And Strauss, sure enough, said, come on, Giles, you've got him in trouble here. Next ball, Warne smash six.
No.
And said to Strauss, do you want to say anything else? And Strauss just kept his mouth shut. So a great story by Andrew Strauss. And it just shows, you know, it was all about the sense of theatre, even with, you know, and that was with the bat in hand. So
it's going to be a big event for his state funeral in Australia. Amazing.
Yeah, I think obviously there'll be a huge, huge turnout. Yeah. You know, he was a massive character here, but you think what it was like in Melbourne, it would be massive. Yeah, very sad.
Now, Manchester United, I was asked about this on a TV sofa today. What about the derby?
Right.
By Eamon Holmes.
Right.
Actually, I knew about the derby. I knew it was Manchester. And I didn't know which team he supports. He's a United fan.
He's a big United fan, isn't he?
Yeah. Apparently, I should have known that. But of course, I didn't. But they were terrible, United, and lost 4-1. And Roy Keane, who is a former player, says that some of these players should be never allowed to grace at Manchester United pitch again.
Absolutely. Roy Keane, former captain of Manchester United, who won probably seven league titles with them, and was their real sort of, you know, hard man through that team. Not just hard man, great footballer. He was doing punditry yesterday, and he didn't spare these United players any of his thoughts and his criticisms. And yeah, quite right, he was just said it was embarrassing, they threw the towel in. And you know, that's something Roy Keane would never have done. He pointed out how they weren't running back, they weren't trying to put tackles in, and they basically just accepted that Man City were the better team.
Yeah, I saw the graphic you used today of him pointing out the four goals where the players just appeared to be statues.
Well, they did, and there was a lack of effort, you know, and that's one thing. He said, as Keane quite rightly pointed out, anyone can lose a football match, but if you're not trying hard enough, that's when it's not acceptable, and especially when you're playing for Manchester United in a Manchester derby.
If they're so bad, how come they're still in fifth place?
Well, it was not a strong league. The top two are way ahead of everyone else in terms of Liverpool and Man City. Then you've got Chelsea, and then there's a group of clubs who are much for muchness, including Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham, Man U, are all sort of in that middling area.
Right.
But, you know, a team of Manchester United's wealth and
resources...
should
be in the top two, shouldn't they?
Should be winning the league, or at least challenging for the league title every season, not clinging on to try to finish in fourth place.
You've sneaked this into the running order here.
I don't know what's next.
I wonder why we're mentioning that, Matt. Is that because that's your favourite, that's your team?
I don't do the running order. That's just happened to have popped up.
Just slipped in there. So Arsenal in fourth place. They beat Watford at Watford, but anyone can beat Watford at Watford, because they're on the second bottom.
Well, we're on the subject of the top four race, as you say. So, a good win for Arsenal yesterday away from home. Four wonderful goals out of the five that were scored. And it does put Arsenal now in...
They won 4-1 as well, did they?
Of the goals scored yesterday, okay. of the yeah. five goals oh, scored okay. in that game, they won 3-2.
Right.
Arsenal scored three wonderful goals.
Yeah.
Watford scored one really good overhead kick. But it means that Arsenal have overtaken Manchester United in this race, this all-important yeah. race for
the fourth place.
Because yeah. of the Champions
and
League.
And they've got games in hand too.
They've got games in hand on Man U. But they have got some difficult games coming up. So they play Leicester, then Liverpool. Tottenham are right behind them. It all means this race for fourth is going to be very exciting. And it has such a big impact on, you know, who you can sign for the following season, how much money is coming in, what wages you can play to pay to players, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a real, you know, it shouldn't be about fourth place for someone like Man U. But for Arsenal, given their recent woes, it will be a great achievement for Arteta, the manager, if you can get him into fourth. They're now in prime position, but I wouldn't be surprised if they manage to mess it up.
Well, anyway, I said to Eamon Holmes, and I'd had to give my verdict on the Manchester derby, did he know the Swindon result? And he didn't.
He didn't know the Swindon result. Well, that's unforgivable.
We won 2-1 at Blackpool.
Not at Blackpool. Blackpool won somewhere. At Stoke.
Oh, well, it was somewhere. They won away anyway. They won
2-1 away.
It
was all going so well.
So I am not in your department. Go and have a look. Who was it?
It was all going so well. And
so
then he said
well.
Blackpool, it wasn't Blackpool.
Division 2.
It was they won at Bradford.
Well, I knew it began with B. What more do you want? And it's up that part of the world anyway, isn't it?
It's not north. A million miles away, you're right.
There we are. That is Matt Gatford, who's got a smile broad as dawn because I've made such a fool of myself in sport again. So Britain throws out an astonishing 6.6 million tonnes of food every year. Shameful, frankly. The average home is wasting the equivalent of 8 meals a week. Unidentified frozen objects in freezers are part of the problem, with families throwing away food that's lingered in the bottom shelf, possibly for months. I know a friend who just emptied her bottom shelf. Stuff had been there for years. This week is Food Waste Action Week, and I'm joined by Helen White. She's Special Advisor and Household Food Waste Expert at the environmental charity RAP. Helen, my friend was horrified by some of the stuff that was in her bottom drawer of her freezer, and it filled 2 sackfuls, went in the bin. Isn't that terrible?
Oh dear. Well, I think this is the thing that we've identified, isn't it? There's these unidentified frozen objects that are lurking in our freezers, and they're contributing to the amount of food waste that arises from our homes every single year. We often fling food into our freezers to be used another day, but we're not always getting it back out again. So a UFO is the stuff that's in the depths of the freezers. We've no clue what it is. We didn't write on it what it was. We keep it just in case, until unfortunately we throw it away.
Some of the things that we also throw away too, Helen, potato, bread, milk, why are we throwing these things away?
So those indeed are some of our most wasted items. Potatoes, bread, milk, meals. We're also throwing away 100,000 tons of poultry and pork every year. Food waste arises because we buy too much and then we don't use what we've bought. The most common reason for food waste is we don't use it in time. We also prepare and cook and serve too much. Those are 2 big reasons why this amount of food and the good food that could have been eaten, which is 4.5 million tons, that stuff that could have gone into our bellies, that would fill Wembley Stadium 8 times.
No, that's a shocking figure, and that's a shocking image too, isn't it? Have we got worse as time has gone on?
Well, household food waste has been on a downward trend.
Right.
We're getting better,
but
there is still so much to do. Over time, we've improved, but actually there's still a huge amount. From the numbers that we've been talking about, households throwing away on average 8 meals a week, there's still plenty to go at. And actually, most food waste post-farm gate, so after the farm, it arises from our homes. 70% of food waste after the farm is arising in our homes. So that means that the other 30% comes from retail, manufacturing and hospitality combined. There's actually a lot we can do about it, and that's where Food Action Week, which comes around once a year, that's where it really focuses. It's on the stuff that we can all do in our homes to make a difference.
So what can we do, Helen? You're on your soapbox now. Tell us what we should be doing.
Well, since we're talking unidentified frozen objects, one of the things that we can do is get to grips with freezing and defrosting, and that can make a difference to the amount of food that's going to waste from your kitchen, and it can help to save money. I think worryingly, we also found out that almost 70% of us think that it's safe to defrost meat at room temperature. That's the exact opposite of Food Standards Agency advice. There are only two safe ways to defrost the food that we've frozen, and that's in the fridge, where it's nice and safe, but it does it quite slowly, or you can use the microwave directly before cooking. So in terms of what we can do, something as simple as getting those UFOs out of the freezer, defrosted in the fridge or the microwave, and made into meals means that good food is going into our bellies and not into bins. Wasting food feeds climate change, and it's bad for our pockets as well.
Of course it is. Now, this is most of this food that we're talking about is disposable food, in the sense it's stuff that's been in the freezer, or stuff we've forgotten in the fridge, or it's past its sell-by date. By the way, I ignore sell-by dates. I have done for years. I do what my mum always did. You eat the food until it's green, and if it goes green, you cut it off and carry on. But what about tins? I remember going through a cupboard once and I found a tin, and it was 4 years past its sell-by date. It was a tin of beans. I opened them. They were absolutely delicious.
Well, something that's in a tin. I mean, a tin is a method of preservation, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's why it was invented.
Yeah.
So something that's in a tin, it's probably going to have a best before end date on it somewhere. And that really is just guidance as to how long that product is going to be good for. If the tin isn't damaged, if it's not sort of, you know, gone rusty or horrible, that food is going to be fine. In terms of date, there are only two that you need to know about as a consumer. One of them is the use-by date. Now, that's really, really important, because a use-by date is about safety. And that's why you're going to see it on things like meat and chicken and fish and prepared meals. That's the one that you really need to take notice of, because that's the safety message. The other one is the best before, and that one's about quality, so you can use your judgment to decide whether it's still good. But on use-by dates and drawing us back to the freezer is your friend. If you've got some fresh food that is approaching its use-by date and you ain't going to use it in time, and I know that life gets in the way, we're all really busy, you can freeze it right up to the use-by date. And what you're doing is you're pushing pause. You're going to buy yourself some more time with that food. But then, of course, what you need to do is make sure that that food comes out of the freezer once you've frozen it, and it gets made into a great meal.
Very good. This week, Food Waste Action Week, how much food do you hope you're going to save that ordinarily might have gone in the waste disposal?
Well, if we can get the nation freezing and defrosting confidently, we could save 15,000 tons potentially of just a few meat products. So chicken, bacon and sausages, and just the ones that are not used in time. So it's really important that we focus on a message like that. But Food Waste Action Week, which begins today, and it's delivered by the Love Food Hate Waste campaign, it's all about making the connection between wasting food and climate change, really. So 80% of us say that we're concerned about climate change, but only a third of us are actually making the link between the food that we're wasting, the stuff that we're putting into our food waste bins, and climate change. Those 6.6 million tons of food waste that's coming from our homes that we talked about right at the beginning, that's responsible for 25 million tons of CO2 emissions. That's more than 5% of the UK's territorial emissions. So it's not just bad for us as people, it's bad for our pockets, and it's bad for the planet as well. And that's why we promote a simple action, something that we can all do, as well as that bigger picture around climate change.
You make a very compelling case, Helen, I have to say. That's Helen White. She's Special Advisor, Household Food Waste Expert at environmental charity RAP. Thanks for joining. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.